Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the HTI2 Proposed Rule Task Force Group 3 Information Blocking and TEFCA meeting. I am Peter Karras with ASTP, and I will serve as your designated federal officer today, acting on behalf of Seth Baczynski. This meeting is open to the public. Public feedback is welcome throughout the meeting. Comments can be made via the Zoom chat feature. Also, there is scheduled time for verbal public comments towards the end of our agenda today. Let's get started with our meeting. I will now begin with roll call of the HTI2 Proposed Rule Task Force Group 3 members. When I call your name, please indicate that you are present. And let's start with our co-chair, Rochelle Prosser.
I am present. Good morning.
Good morning. Shyla Blend has indicated that she will not be joining for today's meeting. Hans Botzendijk. Sooner Davenport.
Present.
Derek DeYoung.
Present.
Steve Eichner. Steve, I do see that you are on. You might be muted. Lee Fleischer.
Present.
Hannah Galvin.
Good morning.
Good morning. Dominic Mack.
Present.
Anna McAllister has indicated that she will be joining for the second half of today's meeting. Katrina Miller Parrish.
Good morning.
Good morning. Chris Mork.
I am here.
Eliel Oliveira. Randa Perkins.
Good morning.
Good morning. Zainab Sumar King.
Good morning.
Good morning. Naresh Sundar Rajan.
Good morning.
Good morning. Cheryl Turney.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Ray Walker.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you. Are there any members I missed or any members who just joined us that would like to indicate that they are present?
This is Steve Eichner. I am here. Can you now hear me?
Yes, we can hear you perfectly. Thanks, Steve. All right. Please join me in welcoming our co-chair for opening remarks and to get us into our meeting. Rochelle, over to you.
Yes. Hi. Good morning. Thank you, Peter. Welcome, everyone, to the first round of actual business with the HTI2 rule. I really thank you for taking the time and making time in your very busy schedules to be here to discuss what we will talk about today on patient and patient access. I expect that it will be a very robust discussion. And I just want everyone to understand that although we are here to discuss about that, the law is what has been already written, and we are working to either approve the law as it is or make recommendations regarding the law, but we have to work within the confines of the guidelines that the ONC has given us. If there is something that we have forgotten or omitted that is of major importance to the section we are discussing today, that can be brought further to a higher level, but we really cannot make major changes to the proposal. It is simply to put the framework behind what the ONC guidelines are. And with that, I will give it back to Peter, and we'll begin.
Great, thanks, Rochelle. So this is the agenda. We're going to get into information blocking enhancements and then a discussion, and then we'll open up the task force recommendation worksheet and then have our scheduled public comment towards the end of today's meeting. If we can go on to the next slide. And this is a repeat of the overall task force charge for HTI2, which we've seen for members to review and provide recommendations on the proposals during the public comment period. With that, we can go into the next slide. And this just highlights the topic for today's discussion. And with that, I will turn it over to Rachel Nelson from ONC to dive into our information blocking enhancements topic. Rachel, over to you. And Rachel, if you're talking, you might be on mute.
okay. Excel, if you could advance the slide, please. All right, so today we're actually going to talk about one enhancement to the information blocking regulations that is proposed in the HTI2 Notice of Proposed Rulemaking. It is the proposed new Protecting Care Access exception. So next slide, please. So I'm going to give you a little, couple overviews of it. We do have slides that go that present a lot of detail about, you know, a lot of detail of the proposed regulation text, but we may not read all of them here. They are here. You have them handy. I also wouldn't encourage everyone, if you have not yet read the preamble discussion of this proposal in the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, you know, please try to find time to do so. And without further ado, the proposal is an exception that would apply to practices likely to interfere with AHI access, exchange, or use that an actor believes in good faith could create or increase a risk of potential exposure to legal action, including investigation, that the actor believes could potentially be brought under law in effect at the time the actor engages in the practice, against patients, healthcare providers, or those who help make providing or receiving care possible, for the mere fact that a person sought, obtained, provided, or facilitated reproductive health care that was lawful under the conditions in which it was provided, or specific to the patient protection condition, the mere fact that a patient has health conditions or history for which reproductive health care is often sought, obtained, or medically indicated. The benefits of this proposal, you know, the high level, that it offers actors certainty that practices satisfying the exception would not be considered information blocking. It would assure patients that the information blocking regulations support actors limiting EHI sharing in response to risks that arise over time, while also continuing to support patients' own access to their EHI and other sharing of EHI consistent with applicable law and patient preferences that fosters better care. The exception would also support continued advances in digitization, interoperability, and public confidence in the nationwide health information technology infrastructure. Next slide. Here's the overview of the exception. An actor's practice implemented to reduce the risk of potential exposure to legal action would not be information blocking when the practice satisfies at least two conditions: the threshold condition and the patient protection condition, or the care access condition. As we note in the proposed rule, some practices in some situations might satisfy all three conditions, but the minimum for an actor's practice to be covered by this exception is threshold plus at least one of the other two exceptions. To meet the threshold condition, there are three requirements that the practice would have to meet. The actor would have to hold in good faith belief that a risk of potential exposure exists. There's a tailoring requirement for the practice. Needs to be no broader than necessary. And there's an implementation requirement. There are specific details for this in the text of, you know, the proposed regulatory text. The practice would need to be implemented based on either an actor's organizational policy or a case-by-case determination. The patient protection condition is applicable to practices an actor believes could reduce the patient's risk of potential exposure to legal action based on the mere fact that reproductive health care was sought or received, or that the patient has a health history of condition for which reproductive health care is often sought, received, or medically indicated. The care access condition would apply to practices an actor believes could reduce potential exposure to legal action of healthcare providers or other persons who provide care or are otherwise involved in facilitating reproductive health care that is lawful under the circumstances in which it is provided. Now, next slide, please. This is a snapshot of how the reg text flows. The threshold condition, patient protection condition, care access condition are shown in their entirety, I believe, on the next three slides, but they're probably the slides I'm not going to read through here unless the work group really wants me to. I wanted to include this to show that this is sort of the structure, and also highlight that there are provisions in here that are not conditions. One is the presumption provision. For purposes of determining whether an actor's practice meets the patient protection or care access condition, care is presumed to be lawful unless the actor has actual knowledge that the care was not lawful under the circumstances in which it was furnished. And we do include in the draft regulatory text a definition of legal action. For purposes of this exception, legal action means any one or more of the things you see listed here. A criminal, civil, or administrative investigation into any person for the mere act of seeking, obtaining, providing, or facilitating reproductive health care. A civil or criminal action brought in court to impose civil, criminal, or administrative liability on any person for the mere act of seeking, obtaining, providing, or facilitating reproductive health care, or an administrative action or proceeding against any person for the mere act of seeking, obtaining, providing, or facilitating reproductive health care. Next slide. And again, this is the text of the threshold condition pasted on the slide. We're not going to take time to read it because I want to leave you guys time for discussion. Next slide. Patient protection condition. Next slide. The care access condition. And next slide with a couple of additional details that are of interest. So in case folks are wondering, what does reproductive health care mean for purposes of this exception, we propose in the rule to adopt in a different section of our regulations the same definition of reproductive health care that is now used for purposes of the HIPAA regulations in 45 CFR parts 160 and 164. We do discuss this proposal in the section, same section of the HTI-2 NPRM where we discuss the protecting care access proposal. Just as a reminder, healthcare provider is defined in section 171-102 of in the information blocking regs, along with other defined terms for purposes of the information blocking regulations. We do propose in HTI-2, as we talked about last week, to clarify the wording of the healthcare provider definition, but not to change its scope. And on this slide, you also have a pointer to which section of the NPRM we discuss the healthcare provider definition wording update. And also a reminder, person is defined in section 171-102, currently codified, by cross-reference to the definition of person in 45 CFR 160.103. So that is the same definition of person that is used for the HIPAA privacy rule. Effective June 25th, 2024, that HIPAA privacy rule definition includes clarification of what natural person means in context of that definition of person. And on this slide, for your convenience, future reference, there's URLs to where you can find the current text of 45 CFR 171-102 and the other regulatory section mentioned in this slide, 45 CFR 160.103. Next slide. That was all I was planning to prepare to you today. Again, I wanted to leave lots of time for the work group to discuss, but I am happy to go back and talk through the detailed slides that I skipped over in this presentation. And I will turn it back. I'm not sure, am I turning this back over to Peter or Rochelle?
It would be me. All right. Peter, we will, and team, thank you so much, Rachel, for that wonderful overview. At this time, we will begin the task force recommendation worksheets. But before we begin that, does anyone have any questions before we go to the recommendation worksheet? Yes, I should see lots of hands. So the first one that I saw, Peter, I'll let you control the questions on who came first.
Sure, the first hand up I see is Ray Walker.
Hi, thank you. Appreciate just a quick clarification for me as I'm familiarizing myself with this. In the section, as it's phrased about legal action against patients, the way this is written, does that definition include legal action against patients' parents or legal guardians?
That's a great question, because I had that question to myself.
You will find in the preamble discussion of the proposed rule, you will find that we do talk about what patient means in this context. And patient in this context means the person who is the subject of the EHI, so the person receiving the care. Patient in this context does not mean individual. It does in the same sense it's used in the HIPAA privacy rule or the same sense we use it in the privacy exception. And we discuss, I'm trying to be very careful here and make sure that I'm only saying exactly what we've said in the rule, because procedurally I cannot say more than what is in the published rule. But in the published rule, we do address that what patient means here, and it means the subject of the EHI.
So if I understand it, this exception, then if the concern on the part of whatever actor was seeking to engage in sort of withholding this information, you know, to not be information blocking, a concern around legal risk for parents or legal guardians is not explicitly spelled out in this rule, the way it's currently written?
I would have to do a word search to confirm whether the word parent appears anywhere in this rule. What we talk about in this rule in the care access condition is persons who facilitate the provision or receipt of care, not just the people who provide the care, but also persons who make receipt or provision of the care possible.
Okay, thank you.
Next hand up is Katrina Miller Parrish.
Before
Mike,
we go
did
there,
you want to jump in?
Yeah, right. Can we go sure. back to the just so they can see the care access threshold or condition?
I think that would be slide 16.
I think that might
yeah.
help.
Mm-hmm. 15.
15. Yes, 15.
We're in the ballpark, though, which is pretty good at that point for slide numbers.
Do you have or other persons involved in providing or facilitating reproductive healthcare?
So I'm looking at this and I'm unclear as to whether those other persons involved would be parents, because parents are not necessarily providing care. Parents would be the person bringing them to care, not necessarily providing that care. We're also responsible to pay for that care, but not necessarily provided under the provisions, like, and correct me if I'm wrong, you know, we're to provide clothing, food, shelter, access.
Yeah, I don't think that's the word you want to focus on.
Yeah, this is, can I have some clarification?
I would encourage you all to read the preamble. I know that you're focused, and I know you have limited time, and I know you're very focused on the reg text, mm-hmm. but the preamble is part of the package deal, and our preamble discussion is where you would find some, I'll say, different wordings than just say provide or facilitate, in talking about things like make the care receipt or provision of the care possible.
Okay. I would like to propose, for time's sake, on this aspect, and if there's other questions, we certainly will. But if we can make time for the team and our work group to go back and look at the preamble, and we can carve out some time at the beginning of our next meeting before we start on the next list, so that if there was any questions there. So I'll send it back for questions, Peter.
Yeah, next hand raised is Katrina Miller Parrish.
Hi, thanks. And I was looking, I think, at the next slide, but it was the one that had the references to the 45 CFR. Yeah. And I was having trouble finding the exact definition. So just in case everyone was having that level of trouble, it looks like the first one is just referring to healthcare provider, and the second one is referring to both reproductive healthcare and person. So if anyone wants to find those definitions, they're in there. What would be great in the future is just maybe to create a slide with those definitions, just so we don't have to go search around for them. And then I agree on the preamble. If we're really referring to the preamble, it'd be great to actually have that on a slide to be able to start off with that understanding and then work through it. I'll admit I had a lot of trouble trying to find the right text, as Rochelle and others are aware. So appreciate any sort of actual text and confirming links, so that we know we're finding the right information to review. Thank you.
That is great feedback. Rachel, you have yourself off mute.
Do you want me to go on mute anytime I'm not responding? I didn't take that as a question so much as a process improvement suggestion.
Okay, no problem.
Next hand is Dominic Mack.
Yes, good morning, everybody. This is coming from a provider with this question, but is it presumed that the patient is in agreement with the exception, right? So I look at it from a provider's point of view, because this is for legal protection of the patient and the provider, but I see where there could be an issue if it did come to legal action where if the patient wasn't informed and we're on two different places. So does it presume that the provider has told the, just like in behavioral health, told the patient, hey, your records will be secure. We won't be sharing. You don't have to, et cetera. That's the question.
So the patient protection provision is subject to override by the patient. If you're just holding it back to protect the patient, and the patient says, I hear you, but do it anyway, it's my risk to take, then you can't meet the patient protection condition at that point. As noted earlier, you only have to meet one or the other for the exception to apply and the withholding of the information not be information blocking.
So I didn't see in there where the patient's consent was part of the prerequisite.
So we did not go back up. I thought we managed to fit the whole thing on. Go back up to the patient protection slide. I think it's Next slide. 14, number 14. And that's where the definition of patient was. So it must, when implemented for the purpose of reducing the patient's risk of potential exposure to legal action, the practice must affect only the access, exchange, or use of whatever specific electronic health information the actor in good faith believes could expose the patient to legal action because it shows or would carry a risk of supporting an inference that the patient obtained reproductive health care, inquired about or expressed an interest in seeking reproductive health care, or has any health condition or history for which reproductive health care is often sought, obtained, or medically indicated. And then the second requirement to meet this condition is that whatever you're doing, when it's implemented for the purpose of reducing the patient's risk of potential exposure, must be subject to nullification by an explicit request or directive from the patient that the access, exchange, or use of the electronic health information occur despite the risk to the patient that the actor has identified.
Okay. All right. Got it. Thank you.
Thank you for your clarification, Dr. Mack. All right. If there are not any further questions, I will ask Excel to show the spreadsheet, and we'll begin working through the legal clauses. And thank you for this robust discussion. It's very good. I hope, Dr. King, you had some of your questions answered from our first meeting last week. Cheryl, would you like to take yourself off mute and just comment? I see you put yes, go ahead.
Hey, thanks. I just did want to mention that, you know, with all the comments that were going in the chat and everyone speaking, the patient should really be any authorized individual that the patient has identified, which could be a caregiver, also what's allowed by law. And then we all need to recall that in many states, there are laws that limit the ability for parents to have access to minors' information if they're above a certain age, and it's not consistent from state to state. So, I don't know that changing the definition of patient here, I don't think that's the intent. I think it always has been to go back to HIPAA in terms of what's defined in terms of the patient, and that always includes the authorized caregivers and or those allowed by law.
Mm-hmm. Well, we were specific to right of access. And I just want to clarify, when you say that, you're referring to right of access, who has the ability to exercise the individual's exactly. Right of access, which this exception, I do want to step in and be clear to clarify two points, just as reminders, that if you're operating under HIPAA or under a state law, and that law that applies to you forbids you from disclosing particular EHI to particular people, don't do it. We don't need to explicitly address that scenario within the exceptions because if, you know, required by law, and I can link you to a couple, I can provide links to a couple of relevant FAQs in the chat if that would be helpful. So, you know, if you're required by law to withhold something from someone, then you don't need to get to this exception. You just need to follow that law.
Yes, if you could provide those links, Rachel, I'm sure that as we're going through this document, we'll have some further discussion later on. And thank you. Yes. Thank you for that.
The other thing that is mentioned and I appreciate you guys making a plan to look into the preamble. The other thing that we do address in the preamble is that meeting this information blocking exception would mean that your practice was not information blocking. Whether you're meeting your obligations, if you are a HIPAA covered entity or business associate under the HIPAA privacy rule, is a separate situation. So meeting this exception would not do away with your obligations to provide the individual's access under the HIPAA privacy rule. That was just the second point of clarification that I didn't want us to miss.
Thank you for that, Rachel. Appreciate it. All right, without further ado, we can begin the first one, the first rule. And I don't know about you. I'm a younger person, but this print is very small. Ah, thank you. All right, so the first one is just, if we can go back to the left, rule number 171206. And I see, Hannah, you are already in. So this one is looking at patient access and the exception. We've pretty much gone over it. And if you're welcome to go into this document, this work group document and draft. I see that we have some questions in column G. And so for those that have put their initials up, I would like to go in order and start discussing your questions regarding the patient. Okay, so KMP, Katrina, go ahead.
That's me. And I understand from your intro that basically we are looking at the regulations according to the law, which I would believe are really focused on reproductive care access. Correct. And so my comments, I think, would be backlog and just, you know, considering that there may be other situations where this kind of care access protection would be important. And I think some other comments supported that as well. So really, that's where I was going with that and understood that that may not be what we're focusing on right now.
When we say reproductive, and Rachel, correct me if I'm wrong, there are other use case scenarios for family planning, which would come under reproductive health, such as if you're an oncology patient and you need to have access to reproductive services to either prevent pregnancy or cause pregnancy after you've finished. So that would be part of it, part of that care that would have to occur for you to receive treatment for another chronic disease condition that would require you to access reproductive services. So that's one area, the IVF fertility would be another. Rachel, please keep me honest if there's another.
Rachel, while I talk, Rachel, can you see if you can grab from the, yeah, that's exactly what's so funny. I was thinking that I was like, grab it from OCR's rule. So just for clarity, because I know this came up originally when we were doing the presentation to HITACH on the entire rule, about this definition of reproductive health care, and does that include gender affirming care and other, as you just mentioned, Rochelle, the other, you know, potential, how do you interpret it? So we have only proposed, to be clear, the definition that has already been codified for reproductive health care by OCR. So it's a cross-reference to their definition. And I would encourage you to look at what they said in preamble. I was wondering if I could bring that up, at least a citation. I'll throw that in the chat. When people brought up gender affirming care as well in their rule, because obviously you wouldn't be surprised that it could come up in that rule. But you should just, you know, I don't think we're going to say more on that. Just to be honest with you, it's not our definition, right? So we won't control the interpretation of that definition. That'll be OCR. I mean, you can make a comment to your views on that, of course, but we're not going to, we did not propose to independently define reproductive health care. We only proposed to take the definition. And this is part of the entire consistency between our rule and the HIPAA privacy rule on reproductive health care. So I'll grab at least the relevant part of their preamble where it was addressed, because they essentially said they're not going to do a list of all different types of care that could fit under reproductive health care. And it is best just to look at the definition of it And if you do have concerns of what's included in that definition, feel free to raise them. But I just want to be clear on what we actually proposed. We didn't propose a definition for purposes of information blocking. We proposed to essentially incorporate the definition that was codified by OCR in their regulations so that there would be consistency in that definition. Rachel, I don't know if you were able to grab it yet. Oh, it looks like you did. Awesome. It's in the chat. And I'm not sure, did you grab also the, I can grab the okay. On-point preamble part, and then I'll turn it to you right now while I do that.
The preamble was going to take me another minute versus just digging into current 160.
And thank you for that. I appreciate the consistency, and I think Katrina does as well. For the purposes of the group, trying to have that consensus and uniformity between where the law originated, what other definitions are currently, and what we're moving forward in this proposal helps to streamline and at least start something along the lines of ensuring that we protect patients in their most vulnerable circumstances. And although it, by not giving an exhaustive list, it may be better for the blanket coverage where we're not asking folks to pick holes and target. And so I just want you to think about that in a more broader context as we move forward and where we see if there is an issue, we can always discuss it at a higher level other than here. And I see a few hands, so I will open it back to the floor. Cheryl?
Thank you so much. Michael, and I wanted to add on that point, one of the challenges that payers have had, which I don't believe has been resolved, and a definition doesn't in itself resolve it, is that when it comes to claims data, we can use CPT codes or something to come up with an alignment as to what that definition means. But when it comes to clinical data, which is really a big part of this, there is not that clear alignment. So I just think somewhere we need to know that it is going to be, the definitions are going to be used and will have to be interpreted. And as far as I know, there's no large language model yet that has said, hey, this is how you would discern either maternity, substance abuse, gender affirming in clinical notes today. You know, we have asked and looked around and have not found that. So everyone's interpretation may be slightly different. And that has to be at least taken into consideration related to the participants in the data sharing, because I think most entities are going to err on the side of caution. And so hopefully that doesn't fall under information blocking, but it falls under protecting the needs of the patient.
Thank you for that, Cheryl. Rachel? Ray?
Thanks. I suppose on the same lines, I can see the value here of aligning definitions and not trying to pick out exceptional cases. I guess I just want to clarify with this threshold condition that includes with it that the institution would have spelled out, kind of clearly what their reasoning and or, particular policies for protecting certain groups of patients might be. Does that leave room? Because even reproductive health care can be so, the definition so culturally specific beyond, what the federal government requires. Does it leave room for institutions to operationalize these definitions in a localized way that might be, some might say, more expansive than what one might strictly think of under the current federal definition of reproductive health care, which is also still quite abstract to the point that was just made about, clinical data?
I would say where ONC would look more to the regulations and the context of the law, what a healthcare facility does or does not do within the confines of the law, within their operation and approval by their legal system, they're entitled to go as far or as simplistic as they would want. I don't know if there's a better answer for that. My understanding, the ONC is not going to tell a healthcare provider or a facility per se how to write a policy as long as it doesn't interfere with the broader federal regulations and the laws that are there to protect the public and other entities. Rachel, or I'm trying to be as social on that as possible without getting myself also into trouble. Would the ONC like to comment, or shall I move on? Michael? All right, well, they are muted, so I guess they are in agreement. Chris?
Thank you. I'm building, I guess, on the commentary provided by Ray. I was going to say something similar. After expressing my disappointment that we are absolutely limited to reproductive health as someone with a target on their back because they seek gender-affirming care, I am disappointed in that restriction. And I see an opportunity here. I don't think we need to just cite that definition that is on the screen, that is all matters relating to the reproductive system. I think there is room to include language that says exactly what Ray did, that institutions are free. We don't see a prohibition on interpreting that broadly. As a concrete example, vaginoplasty, mediaplasty, these forms of gender-affirming care interact with the reproductive system, and therefore, anyone, any institution that chooses to make use of this exception under that definition, we consider that, based on our understanding of this definition, to be something that they are allowed to do. We are not saying they have to, but we are saying if you nail down that definition for yourself, you have met the intent and can be presumed to be in compliance with the rules of this exception, and therefore are not, you can't be brought to, you don't face penalties for information blocking.
I hear what you're saying, Chris. And so I will happily disclose, I live in Florida. And so I can uniquely understand the challenges of what you're discussing. But I also do believe that some of the definitions of the care that you are discussing also lie in other realms that would then be covered explicitly under the reproductive care without specifically having a target on your back, because we're saying we're moving that into gender-affirming care, because that happens in many instances, either in newborn care where the parent needs to decide what sex this child is going to be should there be a birth defect, and then also in allowing a child to develop between the ages of 12 and 14 if they had a chronic condition that would preclude them from having that gender-affirming natural transition from their own body because they had either a chemoactive agent or some other medication that would preclude them and prevent endocrine function. So I worry that in not keeping it broad in general will, by reason of omission, put a target. And I don't think that that's what ONC wants to do. And so we want to at least align it broadly in this context to provide those individual challenges should they arise. And I think
we're saying substantively the same thing, that the definition that's laid out there can be interpreted many ways. An institution that chooses to limit it just to what we sort of stereotypically think of as reproductive health, they are in compliance with the rule as stated. And I think it is safe to note that an institution that has a much broader interpretation, so to include chemotherapy that may interfere with reproductive function, that all of that, as long as it touches in some way on the reproductive system, if your policy says adopts a broad definition, however it defines it, without putting in examples necessarily like oncology or gender affirming care, as long as you have a sound basis for doing so, you are presumed, we saw some presumption language earlier, you are presumed to be in compliance with this exception. That's, I guess, what I'm looking for is make it easy for those institutions, for those actors to say, I am applying this exception and I am covered and I am safe because you have written down, for example, in the preamble, that the intention is that you can interpret this broadly.
I think the ability to really come and say definitively for what you're asking, I'm not sure that the ONC can make that position because there are so many broader different use case scenarios. And I think for the purposes of just getting this passed to the, across the threshold to get it on the books, so we can at least say, okay, that's the law that we are going to point ourselves to as we begin to think about or reimagine crafting healthcare policies that are either protectory or omissions to either cloak or hide or protect. Again, I don't think the ONC can definitively say this is what you do as a healthcare facility, but as long as it follows the context and law of your state, of your legal counsel, and of the healthcare facilities under your license, then you would be able to go ahead and craft it however way you choose based on those regulations. We still have to follow the context of the law. We can't say, okay, we're going to break the law. We have to make sure we fall within the legal definition of that. And we can't say, okay, well, the policy is here, so we're not going to follow the law. That would put ONC and everyone else in jeopardy. We still have to follow the context of the law. And I know
I don't intend to be saying we should break the law. I'm seeing that there is a legal definition of reproductive health care that includes anything that relates to the reproductive system. And therefore, looking at that definition, we could be explicit that we understand that to mean that not just the small set of things that people normally think of fall under that, that it is okay for an institution under its state laws to apply a policy that is as expansive as possible without telling them without what that policy is. I am okay being discreet about it, but making it clear to them that that is a freedom they have under this legal definition so that everybody is on the up and up there.
On that, I think we can concur.
Cool.
All right.
I just want to say one more time.
Yes.
We appreciate all comments. I see them already on the screen. I just want you to, again, be aware of the guardrails of our proposal.
Mm-hmm.
So when when a final rule comes around, we only propose to adopt a definition that another agency defines. Mm-hmm. We do not propose to define reproductive health care ourselves in this rulemaking for the purpose of information blocking.
And I agree. I'm trying to walk a fine line here, Michael. Thank you so much. Lee.
Yeah, not to get too wonky, but I will for a second, because you keep saying law. I assume this is in reg.
Yes.
To statute.
Statutes and regs, yes.
But it's not in statute. It's in the reg from the OCR, correct? The definition?
Correct. I mean, that's semantics, but statutes and regulations are both considered law for purposes of our general counsel.
Right, but having overseen the implementation of EMTALA, I'm just concerned because reg could change, and have we considered the any concerns about being this explicit or tying it to another regulation over time? That's why, as opposed to any kind of statutory, and is there a larger statutory authority with regard to information blocking, or was it really given at the discretion of the secretary?
Yeah, so our statute is pretty clear for information blocking. There's a definition that Congress gave us in the Cures Act. And then our job is to interpret the terms of those definitions, such as what is a healthcare provider, what is an interference, for example. And then more specifically, the statute gave the secretary, which was delegated to ONC, but still everything is signed and approved by the secretary, to identify reasonable and necessary activities that would not be information blocking. And to that point, we call them exceptions. This is one exception that we are proposing. There is no additional statutory, legislative history on this point, obviously. I mean, the Dobbs case came after the Cures Act, I think HIPAA, just a word on the process, if people understand how regulations are developed, before they're even proposed for the public to comment on under the Administrative Procedure Act, they do go through a vetting process in the department, and then even all of the federal government, including the Department of Justice, the reviews our regulations before they are put out. So that's just part of the process.
So Michael, I've lived through that. So that's why my question is, and having watched regulations change, is there an opportunity, just like in EMTALA, where reproductive health is specifically called out, but being a little broader, and include reproductive health? In other words, is there any, that's my comment, because you may get comment as part of the notice and comment rulemaking in this area. So that's why I wanted to bring it up. It's regulatory.
Right. And regs can always change. Interpretations of statutes can change as well. So now our interpretation of all these terms, like what's an interference or subject to the court, and they don't have to defer to our interpretation anymore. So there's that. And as you pointed out, regulations can always change. All the exceptions are done via regulatory process. So any administration can change, propose through rulemaking to change regulations, change exceptions, or propose new ones or remove exceptions. That is the process that has been set up through statute. So I hear your position. I welcome these comments, and I'm not discouraging you to make any of these comments. I am just giving you the legal guardrails that we'll be under, to level set expectations under the Administrative Procedure Act and case law. When you propose something, if you haven't proposed something else, it is a substantial legal risk to finalize something you did not propose, because the public has not had an opportunity to comment on that. There's these concepts of logical outgrowth. We only proposed to adopt we didn't propose our own definition of reproductive health care for the purpose of information blocking.
I'm actually saying something different, Michael. Asking, you specifically anchored on reproductive health care. So certainly
the exception. Yeah, it is very limited. Right.
It's very limited. So and we've heard today comments, and there could be logical outgrowth for additional comments. I realize it's at some risk. And I don't know if the high-tech comments are, I assume they're part of the official record, such that logical outgrowth could be construed.
We don't have to get a big, I don't represent our general counsel, so I have to be clear about that. I'm not allowed to provide legal advice or guidance. Right. But just because you get a comment on something that you should do, that doesn't mean everybody, do you understand? Like the entire public didn't right. know about your comment and then comment on your comment. So logical outgrowth is really based on what was proposed. What could you foresee based on what was proposed by the agency, not on what comments came in, and based on those comments you changed your view. So I can't, like I said, there's a lot of lawyers looked at our rule. That's all. Yes. I will say,
let me help you out, Michael. Lee, for your question, if you feel that there is something that if you feel that there is something that needs to be taken to a higher level that we just cannot address here due to the confines of what the goals and purposes are for our meeting in this work group, we are welcome to bring it to LEL and to the other leaders on the High Tech Commission. But just understand that in this context of where we are within this work group, we really have to stay within the boundaries of what is presented in our definitions and approving definitions.
I want to be clear. No, you're not. You can make any comment. You're not. Any comment can be made on a rule. We get comments all the time about you were too narrow in what you proposed. You were, or overly broad or ambiguous, or all those comments are welcome. That's why I'm saying these comments you have on the screen are very much welcome. I'm just trying to give you what we proposed and what we didn't propose, right? If we said, we'll tell you different parts of the rule, we give alternative proposals. So we have a main proposal, and the alternative proposal puts out a bunch of different options. Sometimes it's how many days should we wait, apply to a particular set of circumstances, under the feasibility exception. And in that case, those are all public has knowledge of, we could go in any one of these directions. Right? Because we've told them that this is a possibility. While we have a main proposal, there's all these other proposals. I was just trying to explain that part to you, how the rulemaking process works and what likely we'll be looking at in a final rule and, cabined in what we can do in a final rule, even based on comments, because it isn't something we proposed. So that's all I was trying to get at. In terms of interpretation of, the definition that we propose, OCR is obviously can make any interpretation of their own definition. Mm-hmm. I was just pointing out, we didn't propose we propose either to adopt the OCR's definition of reproductive health care, or alternatively, we propose this definition of health, and then we could have, we could be talking differently. That's all I was trying to point out is what we actually proposed. The definition that you see, in the chat, and that isn't a definition we came up with. It's a definition, obviously, that's been already codified, and we thought it best, for various reasons, to adopt that same definition.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you.
But yeah, comments about hey, you missed this, or we're not sure if this is in scope, are always welcome. Because so I want to be clear about that.
All right, thank you. Hannah.
Thanks, Jill. Two quick comments. One, I also was very confused. And I think part of it had to do with the reference to the definition of reproductive health care in 45 CFR 160. And it wasn't until I searched the rest of HIPAA, the HIPAA legislation, and found the sort of several paragraphs about reproductive health care and the prohibition and the rule of applicability, that where reproductive health care is really carved out in HIPAA, right? Just the fact that there's a definition along with all of the other definitions in 160, it left me very confused about why are we carving out just reproductive health care here. And so I might suggest to ASTP and ONC to also reference that 145.164C, the part where HIPAA is actually carving out those regulations around reproductive health care, because just as a reader of this rule, I was very confused about the reference just to the definition at the top. But I am no lawyer by any means, so I don't know how things should be referenced. But secondly, just to sort of call out, I know we've talked about gender affirming care. Oh, thank you, Rachel. Appreciate that. Thank you. I really appreciate the discussion about gender affirming care and sort of echo that. The other thing I do want to call out is about immigration. And I put some of those comments in the document itself. And Rachel, you're probably very familiar with this, living in Florida. There has been evidence of immigrants not seeking care after laws have been passed requiring them to disclose their immigration status. And I understand that there is no sort of legal precedent to kind of go on around information blocking, but I did not want to lose the chance to sort of advocate on behalf of sort of needing more protections around other areas in addition to sort of this narrow definition. That's all I have. Thank you.
Hannah, I thank you for bringing those points up, and thank you, Rachel, for referencing the preamble. I think I have spent a week and a half going through line item on all of these areas, and I want to allow the ONC to lead where applicable so that we stay within the scope. The comments are valid. I even think that as a new immigrant coming to this country and you become a citizen or are in that process of becoming a citizen, there is that misconception or misunderstanding of what is covered and what they are allowed or isn't allowed to do as they come from different countries. And so thank you very much for bringing that up. Another area that may have different governance is looking at the Native Indians and what their treaties say in terms of what is the law that they will follow within their lands and within their borders. And I would defer to Sooner on that to discuss more, to see where it is applicable or isn't applicable and where, and to provide comment in that space to ensure that as we look for equal protections under the law, that we are taking in all populations, whether new or older. So Sooner, would you like to comment or shall I continue?
No, thank you. I believe I was like in a listen only mode last week. So I believe I think I asked a question similar to this about that at the time the question was about acknowledging tribal law, because that's critical to acknowledging the public health jurisdiction or the health system of the tribe, or Indian Health Service, which gets more complicated if it's IHS versus tribe sometimes. And I believe there was a follow-up that there is something addressed in Cures Act, which kind of better defines that. Because the issue that does come up is that tribes will bring forward their standard or their law. And then this happens a lot with Indian Health Service, but it can, and a lot with states is they'll say, well, we don't need this. We need this other document or this other other process to validate this. So I think that's where we see that often in terms of defining what the system is and what it looks like as well. And so I think once we do that, then we can kind of look at some of those other questions, especially for this topic specifically. I will say for the reproductive health, they tend to follow IHS policy, Indian Health Service, how they look and define at reproductive care. So that closer look would need to be through that lens to inform what occurs there. Is that helpful, Rochelle, to the group?
Yes, that's very helpful. Thank you. Rachel or Michael?
I'll just look in and say, I think it would be, so I would find it helpful, I think, to let you guys distill that into writing. I sometimes can process things easier when I see the words than when I hear the words, and that is a me thing, but I would appreciate you all, accommodating that. I will just note that, I can give you a citation to the CARES Act final rule. It was our regulation where we said an information blocking actor subject to a state or tribal law that expressly prohibits a certain access, exchange, or use of EHI can comply fully with that state or tribal law without implicating the information blocking regulations. I can probably find a better chunk of discussion once I see in writing what your question is, so I can better process your question, because we also, we have said in a couple of different places, how tribal laws factor into things like required by law for purposes of the information blocking, the information blocking exceptions. And the information blocking definition, where the information blocking definition itself says, except, it's practices that are not required by law. And so we interpret required by law in the CARES Act final rule, which is probably the first place I'm going to give you a link to. But I just wanted to note that. I did just want to note I'm about to share something that may be helpful, but it may not exactly answer your question because it's a me thing. I'm not sure I fully understood it.
No, that's fine, Rachel. I appreciate that. Bringing up that section will help us more craft it a little bit better and sooner. With your comments there, they're very applicable. Would you like to lead or place a comment under this section so that we could add at that or put reference to that? And Hannah, I ask you to do the same where you're referencing the rule 45, if you could provide that in the comment section on top on this spreadsheet so that we can have consistency or at least have a point of reference to help us guide under the HIPAA. Raise of hand or a voice. Yes, I will need a yes from Hannah and Sooner. And you're both on mute. Go ahead, Sooner.
Yes. Is this something we'll be discussing in future? I'm a little clear on that.
Yes. Okay, yes. We will discuss it at our next meeting just to have the rest of the group know where we're pointing.
Yes, I can do that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ben. Hannah, that was a yes?
It was yes.
Okay, thank you. All right. Ike, go ahead. I'm ready.
Thank you. 2 points. One, I'm a little concerned about impacts on public health reporting, especially in regards to pregnancy status, which is a variable we often collect in association with infectious disease and other health status components, as well as things like birth defects, because that information is really vital for controlling disease and managing things in that space. Outside of public health, thinking about it from a patient safety perspective, looking at things like pregnancy status, where there might be a referral for radiological treatment or something else that would be at risk, and it would be good to catch that earlier rather than later. So thinking about those impacts of blocking that information. There are also some technological impacts in terms of looking at actually operationalizing that information exchange, where a field like pregnancy status might be required from the data exchange standpoint. Well, if you're blocking the exchange of that information, what then becomes the technological change for populating that field. So that's a technology impact that would need to get worked through, and potentially even looking at changing some of the implementation guides to support it where there's not an option to say non-reportable.
Rachel and Michael, would you like to take a first stab, or would you like me just to answer?
If you feel like you can, please go ahead.
I certainly can. So first of all, I want to thank you for your questions. And yes, they are valid. But for the sake of protecting information where it is going to be used against you, I do not believe that the ONC is saying in this instance here that we're not going to provide the data to fill the fields. What we're looking at is, are we going to share that with an entity that is going to use this information for a purpose or a manner that will be hurtful to the general public who is affected by the disclosure of that information. So without being a contrarian on the group, I don't think that we are saying you cannot collect that information and you cannot populate that field. I think that that information and that access to that information for very critical care where necessary, it's what's included in behind that. So an example, agreed, you don't want to know that somebody's pregnant when you're providing a radiological event where they will be hurt. But then they can go further with that test to check and see, well, is there semen in there? Depending on the age, that becomes information searching for punitive purposes. And so in those instances there, we do have to provide a privacy and protection for the general public where it would be applicable.
I understand that there's nothing in regulation that says it can't be collected, mm-hmm. that the regulation is about blocking the disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly the issue, is that from a public health perspective, looking at identifying what constitutes the definition of a risk, a non-medical risk to the individual, it enables a provider to not report information that is required reporting under state law, and that interferes with public health operations.
You want to get that, Rachel?
Yeah, Mike, you think no.
All right. Yeah, that's not what it does. So like there's no preemption.
No.
So and we make that clear in the preamble. So if there are other laws that you have to comply with, yes, you won't be an information blocker, but you will be subject to that other state law if you were that it required reporting of certain information.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have that. HIPAA is different. There are different things going on there with their law and preemption. But this, our law has no specific preemption granted either. As Rachel notes, these are voluntary exceptions. What it does is like not double penalize you. Like, you could be an info blocker for not providing it and for not, your state law. So what it does is takes away the information blocking.
It does complicate things a little bit on the enforcement side. If individuals are then claiming an information blocking exception, it puts an additional burden on public health to then potentially having to pursue it legally. So that's something we may want to be cognizant of going forward.
I think that in providing that legal premise of saying why they need it, would then provide clarity on the use case scenario in the case for what you're saying there, Ike. But for the purposes of what the guideline is or the rule that is ahead, in presented in front of us to provide uniformity between the different government entities in terms of what the definitions are. I think that the scenario that you're bringing up may or may not apply, because again, as I was speaking with Chris, we're looking at exceptions to the rule, as you're talking in this case here. And so where legal action will have to preside, then that would be, that would fall under a use case or one by one. Every hospital has their own policies and guidelines on how they provide care in terms of when it comes to diagnostics and what conditions or other conditions that are there. They have to follow those hospital policies and procedures first in order to protect the public. And that would also include any information sharing that would have to occur for the public health monitoring. So I think it's a, although you're, what you're saying can have an issue in terms of sharing, but we're not, I do not think that we are using this purpose to prevent the natural course and order of sharing information in public for public health, such as this is a birth and this is the birth defect, all of those other things that should actually be there because there are other laws governing that. I hope that answers your question.
And Rochelle, I just wanted to do a time check. We are scheduled to go to public comment in about a minute.
About a minute.
I do see Chris, that you have your hand up.
Thank you. Go ahead, Chris.
I was going to respond to, I mean, I think it's an excellent comment that Ike brought up, and that the way the exception is constructed, you must make your policy as narrow as possible to cover the intended or to provide the intended protections, and crafting it in such a way that precluded you from sharing information for public health use is unlikely to survive that as narrow as possible scrutiny. Perhaps there is a place where ONC can, in the response to the comments that have been made, make it clear that the intention is that you still have to report for public health, because any policy that denied that would not ascribe to that notion of being a limited case exception.
Thank you. Very relevant point. So with that, I will turn it over to Peter to open up public comments.
Sure. Thanks, Rochelle. So we would like to open the meeting for public comments at this time. If you are on Zoom and would like to make a comment, please use the hand raise function that is located on the Zoom toolbar at the bottom of your screen. If you are joining today by phone only, press star 9 to raise your hand, and once called upon, press star 6 to mute and unmute your line. And I will pause for a moment to see if we have any members of the public with any questions or comments. I do not see any raised hands at this time, but I will wait a little bit more and just throw out a couple of reminders that the next Group 3 meeting will be on Thursday, August 8th from 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Eastern. A reminder that all HITACH meeting materials can be found on healthit.gov. I'm not seeing any raised hands at the moment, and Asel has notified me that we do not have any folks on the phone who wish to comment. So Rochelle, I can yield back the rest of the time to you.
Thank you, Peter. I just want to thank everyone on the call today. As you can see, this is why you were chosen to be here. This was such a wonderful, robust conversation. And so for the next steps, our takeaway today is that when we meet on the 8th, we will meet at 11 a.m. to 12:30. But before that, I would like to have a moment where we carve out maybe 5 or 10 minutes to revisit this, to allow those on the call to go through the preamble and have some a little bit of clarity before we move to the next topic. We have a lot to do, and we only just scratched the surface. And I really thank you for having an openness and willingness to have this topic discussion. And I encourage you to please go to the spreadsheet, the working document, and add your comments there. And I would really look forward to our next meeting next week. And hopefully we can move forward in these rules so that we are able to bring them to the full meeting on 9/5. So at this time, I'll turn it over to Chris. If there are any questions from the panel, please raise your hand. Otherwise, I will return the rest of the time. And thank you, Rachel, for the links. All right, Peter.
Thanks, Rochelle. Meeting adjourned. I'm not seeing any other hands raised or any questions coming through.
Thank you for coming, everyone. And I look forward to seeing everyone next week. Take care.